Thank you for joining us, and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and for those of you that have been listening, sending in questions and comments, thank you so much, and please continue to help spread the word that Answers Network brings on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases, entertain, while bringing answers and options to making our lives happier, healthier, and more successful. And remember, if you can't listen live, go to our website at answers.network. Browse through a variety of heartfelt and enlightening topics. I am confident that there will be something that you will find to bring greater joy to your life. Now, I also have a favor to ask of you. Please forward one of our shows to your social media group and to someone you know who can benefit from today's subject together. Now, our topic today is also the title of our guest's new book, Exhale, Hope, Healing, and a Life in Transplant. Now, Exhale is the riveting memoir of a top transplant doctor who rode the emotional roller coaster of saving and unfortunately losing lives until it was time to step back and reassess his own life. Our guest, Dr. David Weil, is the former director of the Center for Advanced Lung Disease and the Lung Transplant Program at Stanford. He is currently the principal of Weil Consulting Group, which focuses on improving the delivery of transplant care. Dr. Weil's writing has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, Newsweek, the Chicago Tribune, Stat, and the Washington Post. He has also entered on CNN Chronicle and the Wall Street Journal. He lives with his wife and two daughters in New Orleans, which is a place that I dearly love. So, David, welcome to Answers Network.
Thanks, Alan, and I love it here too. So, thanks for having me.
Well, next time I go, I'll have to give you a buzz because it is certainly one of my favorite places. You know, one of the things that if we could start with, if you could just share a little bit about your background and what led you to specialize in performing transplants.
Yeah, I was always one of those kids that knew that they were going to be a doctor. And I come from a medical family. My wife is a nurse. My mother's a nurse. My father was a physician. And I was pretty sure I was going to enter medicine, but didn't know what field. And then one day, early on in my medical career, he was up from medical, got sick on the kidney transplant service, and they called me into action, not knowing much at the time. And the first night we did a transplant, and I was hooked. It was a gentleman that hadn't been able to urinate in 11 years. The surgical team put a new kidney in him, and he started urinating a few hours after surgery. And I thought, my God, this is something special. And it was like a jolt of lightning going right through me. And I was really hooked for life. And it just so happened that I wanted to focus on the lungs, and where I went to do my lung training in Denver, they were opening up a lung transplant program in the infancy of lung transplantation in the early 90s. And I was at the right place at the right time.
Well, it just sounds like a wonderful way to be able to make a huge difference. And one of the things I'm doing my research, there's a huge shortage of organs and tissue to be used for transplants. Now, is this true? And if so, what can people do? What can our listeners or viewers do to help doctors like yourself save lives?
Yeah, that's an important topic, Alan, near and dear to my heart. So at any one time in our country, there's around 110,000 people waiting for one of the four solid organs, heart, lung, kidney, or liver. Mm-hmm. So around 110,000 people, and every day, 17 die on the waiting list every single day. And as it stands now, even when we approach families that are suitable donors, only about 50% are actually going to consent for donation. So it's a 50-50 proposition. And in fact, in certain parts of the country, in certain socioeconomic status groups, that percentage is even lower, is to please not only sign your donor card when you get your driver's license, but tell your family members around you, tell your family mm-hmm. and friends that you want to be an organ donor, because they're the ones that are very likely to be asked by medical professionals if that time were to come.
Is there a particular website, again, when I was researching it, that people can go to either get more information so that maybe they can feel more comfortable or their loved ones can feel more comfortable?
Yeah, it's a state by state designation. So your individual states, if you just type in, say, okay, Louisiana and organ donation, there'll be a place to register. And you can, of course, do so at the Department of Motor Vehicles. But I want to reiterate again that aside from doing that, just tell your family, because a lot of times when we approach family members and so they feel uncomfortable, let's make them feel comfortable and tell them what we want to do while we're still alive.
Right. And well, it sounds like what you're saying is that they're wondering if they just checked the box and didn't really think about it. And so you're saying that, so by sharing it with them, then you're saying, look, this is something I really want to do, because even after my life here, I want to still know that I'm helping other people.
You got it. And, you know, just to put some real stats around it, each person can actually save 8 lives if they agree to become an organ donor. So tell your families and friends that's what you want to do.
Well, I certainly will. And again, for everybody out there, highly suggest you do the same. And for anybody that's watched or listened to this show, they know that I love success stories. I love incredible stories. So to one of your really, and how that inspired you to write a book about it.
Yeah, I like success stories too. And, you know, as a matter of fact, that's the reason I went into the field, is we could so with organ transplant, so dramatically turn around somebody's life, literally snatch them from death, and with an operation and then the postoperative care, set them on a whole different course. It's the, I used to call it with our team, the ultimate reset button. And, you know, I really have hundreds of these stories, but the one that stick out to me most is when we went outside of the box a little bit, and when we didn't do the conventional transplant, we took a risk on some people that weren't considered transplant candidates and were turned down by other programs. And a 36-year-old former college football player, the rare form to do is see his daughters grow up. That's all he wanted. Mm-hmm. And he came to us with this rare form of lung cancer after being turned down by multiple centers because lung cancer was not considered a transplantable disease. So we at Stanford decided to take him on and to take that risk. And he did great. And we're so glad we did. We got him back to his job. He was an engineer, and we got him back to his family. Another instance was a 19-year-old boy who was developmentally delayed, had some cognitive impairment, and a lot of centers, a lot of transplant programs wondered if he could be compliant with the medical regimen because of his intellectual capabilities. Again, we took a risk on him. We thought his family support was there, and we ended up transplanting him, and he went on to live for 20-plus years. And these are the things that got me out of bed every morning. I never set an alarm clock. My wife can attest to that. I was pretty much ready to go each morning because of stories like this.
Well, being as we're doing this interview in 2022, how has the pandemic affected transplant surgeons, patients, and their families?
Yeah, it's a good question, Alan. And it's the pandemic's affected transplantation in a number of ways, and I'll just walk you through a couple of them. You know, when it hit in the spring of 2020, transplant activity essentially ceased for a period of time, really a couple of months. A lot of different reasons for that. One was the same folks that do transplant work were extremely busy taking care of COVID patients that were very sick and needed their care. Right. And then the second reason was that hospitals didn't want infection to their hospitals moving back and forth. So that activity really ground to a halt for a couple months, and then, you know, started going up in the summer of 2020. And then now is not only back to pre-pandemic numbers, but has surpassed them. And that's one way the pandemic has impacted it. But the other way that folks may not be quite as aware of is that a lot of people that both have acute COVID pneumonia, meaning actively sick with it, on the ventilator, essentially dying, are requiring a lung transplant to survive. And so there's been a few hundred already done in our country where COVID patients had no other alternative but lung transplantation. A lot of success stories there. There's another group that I'm a little concerned about that might require a lung transplant, or those that got sick with COVID, not talking the sniffles, right, that kind of COVID. I'm talking about the really sick COVID patients that may have irreversible lung damage from the infection, and they also may require a lung transplant. We'll see if that's true. That should take another year or so to really play out.
Well, and I think you must have been reading my mind, because that was my next question that had to do with, you know, it appears as though a lot of the people that got really sick, that the issues were in their lungs, and many of which were put on ventilators, and, you know, and obviously many people passed away. But you're right, that was my understanding, was that we now have more people dealing with lung issues from COVID that they may have to deal with for the rest of their life, or if it's more serious, that was going to be my question. You know, do they become good candidates for lung transplant?
I think that they will. You know, as you know, and I'm sure your viewers and listeners know, there were a lot of healthy young people that got infected and terribly sick with COVID. At the beginning of the pandemic, right, we thought it was going to only happen to the elderly or those with pre-existing medical conditions. But we all know now that that's not universally the case. So some of those folks are very young and otherwise very healthy, and I think will come to transplantation in the future.
Yeah, and we have some questions that have come in, and there was one that came in about COVID. And again, I want to thank those people that take the time to send in questions. I know we get quite a few from teachers that are working in the middle of the day, and they then say that they listen later on in the evening for the answer. So this one is along those lines. It says, I'm very curious how COVID has affected transplants, especially the vaccine reports of spike proteins that are reported to be accumulating in the various organs and the potential damage to the heart in young donors. This is from Miriam in Georgia.
Yeah.
Thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's a good question, and it speaks really to how we assess potential organ donors. I think that we're now careful, of course, to make sure that the people that are donating the organs are not currently infected with COVID. But we're also recognizing that since so many people have had the infection, are there any long-lasting effects and any evidence of organ dysfunction in those folks? And so we carefully screen, for instance, the heart, which speaks to the question, and make sure that it's really working well before we put it in anybody else. We do the same thing for the lungs, the kidneys, and the liver as well. So I think that we're in pretty good shape with regard to that.
So, and then we have another one from, this is from Kathy in Ohio, and I know you touched on a few of your experiences, but this one reads, what are some of the most successful and miraculous transplants you experienced in your career?
I think that, you know, another one that sticks out, I also write about in the book, was somebody that really was within hours of dying, not only was on the mechanical ventilator, as we used to call it, with all knobs to the right, which means maximal support, maximal oxygenation, mm-hmm, but was also on something called ECMO therapy, which is extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, which is a machine that essentially takes the blood out of you, oxygenates it, and puts it back in you. It's something that COVID patients have also gotten, but some of our pre-transplant recipients require as well. And, you know, to be sitting in an ICU with a patient that really out of tricky on the waiting list, and you're essentially staring at your cell phone, waiting for it to go off, kind of willing it to go off, was a big part of my career. And I've got in mind a young woman who's, I think, around 23 years old, who was in that very situation. And we got the organ call as I was sitting at the ICU bedside, and I told the team, let's go, hurry. And we ended up getting it done, you know, due to a great team effort. And she ended up, you know, walking out of the hospital a couple of weeks later. Pretty amazing.
Yeah. But, and it sounds like, from what I'm getting from you, that This might be the kind, if you're sitting there and you're waiting, this is somebody you think may only live for hours rather than days, weeks, or months.
Absolutely. We can certainly tell, who's got some time and who doesn't. And sometimes we can even tell if it's a matter of hours versus a matter of days. And we also reach a point with certain patients where they've even gotten too sick to transplant. In other words, the chance of success would be so low because they're so awfully sick that if we were to put a new organ in them and try to do this big operation, they wouldn't make it through. So we kind of had to balance all of those factors when we decided to go for it in a situation like I just described.
Well, what does happen when transplants fail and they're just not enough to save that patient?
It's gut-wrenching. Yeah.
It's got to be one of the hardest things for you to deal with.
I must say it's very difficult. It's a long walk out of the ICU to a patient's family's waiting room to talk to them and to tell them it's not going to happen. I had to do that. I think that the two most difficult groups of patients that I cared for emotionally were the ones that I'd gotten to know for 15, 20 years. I knew their kid's name, their wife's name, their dog's name. I knew their hobbies. I knew everything about them. And then to have them pass away after transplant, that was tough. But the patients that were on our waiting list who never even got a shot at it are the ones that really stuck with me the longest and actually still do, because I think I felt strong responsibility to get them to the transplant at least. And then after that, we see what happens. But the ones that we couldn't get to the transplant, that's tough.
Wow. So, and we've got another question that's coming in. This one it reads, says, I read an article back in 2020 about the University of Maryland researchers working with newly established stem cells from pigs that could provide a solution for growing transplantable human organs. What are your thoughts on this, and will it be a solution to the organ shortage anytime in the future? And this is from Andrew in New Jersey.
Yeah, look, there's a lot of excitement going on in our field right now because, and this has been in the lay press, really all over the lay press lately, about xenotransplantation, which is the transplantation of animal organs into humans. So the first pig heart transplant into a human was done, I'm going to say, a month or so ago in Maryland. Genetically engineered hearts so that we stripped away all the immunity factors that would cause it to reject if it were put into a human. And we also, we meaning the transplant community, also put in genes that would allow a tolerance of the organ once it went in. That patient's still alive and doing reasonably well, so I hear. And if we were to be able to do that, and I just want to emphasize that's experimental, that's early stage, this is early days. But if we were able to do that on a large scale, we could whittle that 110,000 person waiting list down pretty fast because we've, got the technology to do it right now.
Now, you said that you were doing something genetically as well. Is that so that the body doesn't reject it?
That's exactly right. Animal organs, of course, an animal, immunologic system is different than ours. And we have the existence of the editing that can be done. So you change the genetic makeup of the organ so that it's more human-like and it'll be tolerated better, even if it comes from a pig.
Wow. I mean, I first of all, I love that, and again, I'm so interested in anything that we can do like this that can save lives. But I mean, that makes perfect sense. Now, is there a particular group that is working on that in regards to the genetic, or is that still something that in essence the transport people are working on? Or do you have a separate group that's working on that and providing that for you?
Yeah, it's a you know it's a it's an effort between academic medical centers and the private sector, who have companies, for instance, that are into the genetic of that's their mission. So it's a real partnership, and you see this actually across transplantation for sure, and I'm involved in some of that now, but you also see it in healthcare at large. We need that marriage between the academic medical centers who are doing a lot of the early stage research and our partners in industry really to make it work. We won't get the healthcare that we need if that partnership doesn't exist. And I think we actually saw that in stark relief with the vaccine development for COVID, where the government certainly had their hand in it, but the private companies did a lot of the heavy lifting to get that shot in our arms. And I think we need to remember that.
Well, now that brings up a point that I've been thinking about a lot that has to do with the vaccines that were fast-tracked, and they were done in within a year, let's say, to do this. And yet we're told that many things like what you're doing, like being able to do transplants that are saving as many or more lives. Is this going to open the door that more things are going to be able to be fast-tracked, and that we don't have to wait 20 years for, say, this latest thing with, with using part of a pig, that we don't have to wait 20 years to where it goes to the point in which major groups of people could have access to that?
I hope so. I think that, and I don't think this is a controversial statement, the FDA process is too slow. And I think that there's a lot of different reasons for that. But a lot of brain at large that are just slowed down incredibly so by the FDA process. And of course, I think the FDA would say that safety is their number one concern, as it should be. But it's not just safety reasons that that process is so slow. It's bureaucratic ones as well.
I would agree, and I would love to see something to where they would go to doctors like you. And if you have a list like this, and you mentioned earlier that there are some people that that have hours or days left of their life, couldn't there be another list that they go on to do things that are a little more experimental, and go, if it doesn't work, they weren't going to make it anyway, and at least we're going to get so much more knowledge from that instead of saying, well, sorry, we haven't approved that, and then they pass away.
And right now is that you may have heard about for experimental therapies, but even that is too slow. We a lot of times in medicine, we just don't have the luxury of time. It's Saturday afternoon and we don't have till Monday. And that's just the nature of this business. And even in efforts to try to get that process sped up so that patients can get an experimental therapy, it's still too cumbersome.
And so, and you were talking earlier, and you mentioned about one of the issues is that, there are essentially lower income areas where, they're probably being even having less of a chance. Is this something that, and you mentioned healthcare, is this something that healthcare is covering? So opening it up to transports are for people that are of a high enough income that they can get it done.
Yeah, transplant is covered by really many commercial payers and all government payers, meaning Medicaid and Medicare. So the
Okay,
transplantation
good.
itself is covered. Now, that's the good news. The bad news is, and my group studied this at Stanford, there's still racial disparities with regard to access to transplantation on every level as you work your way through the transplant process. Also, we and I'm sure your viewers and listeners would know this, not all insurance is created equal. And so there's some plans that'll pay for the basic whatever, the basic operation, but there's so many other costs associated with a complex therapy like you think about those medications, and our patients are on 15 of those medicines. So even if the copay for each of them is not very high, when you add them all together, it's pretty high. And then secondly, you know, we transplant folks that are all over the country, and for them to get transportation back to our center, to sometimes stay in a hotel while they're waiting on a clinic visit or a procedure that they need, those costs add up, and they're really not covered in most respects by conventional healthcare insurance. And instead, it's the patient's responsibility, or in some instances, like at Stanford, when I worked there, we had a fund that was essentially set up to supplement what health insurance didn't cover, and it didn't cover a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, what it made me think was, some years ago, I was one of many people that participated in it, and it was a GoFundMe project, and it was for a friend that was on a waiting list. But one of the issues was that even with, and I think, I mean, insurance was covering a fairly large amount of money. I mean, it seems like it was like over $250,000 or whatever that they were going to cover. There was still $60,000 that wasn't, and this particular friend could not afford $60,000. Yeah. And so, you know, we did a GoFundMe page to be able to try to help. But I think that I love the fact that you're saying you guys set up a fund to be able to try to help people to get through that portion that that isn't covered. So it's very nice. All right. So for everybody out there, we are talking about a new book out called Exhale: Hope, Healing, and a Life in Transplant. My guest is Dr. David Weil. We're going to take a break. Stay with us. When we come back, I'm going to ask him some things about the future of transplant. We'll be right back.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals and educational consultants. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services and West Shield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. You are listening to or watching Answers Network. My guest is Dr. David Weil. And when we left, we talked about the future. And David, I consider myself a bit of a futurist, and I'm always looking for how we're going to either extend or improve human life. What excites you the most when you look at the future of transplants?
I've always had a focus, as I think I alluded to in your first segment, showing the mind throughout my career. It was important to me. One part of the transplant process that I do not think works as well as it could is the organ distribution system. In other words, how do we get an organ that's been identified, or a donor that's been identified at a remote hospital, say hundreds of miles away from where the transplant's actually going to happen at the recipient hospital? There's a system in place to do that I don't think has evolved as much over the decades, and that's how long it's been in place, as it should have. And so there's technology available now that, instead of how we're doing it, get the organ out of a donor, pack it in ice, essentially an ice chest, rush back to the night work, and it's tough. A lot of choreography involved in doing that. So there's technology available now that keeps these organs alive for extended periods of time. perfuses them with blood, ventilates them in the case of the lung transplants, mm-hmm. and essentially keeps them in a situation like they're still in a human body. And even more than that, we can treat those organs with various therapies while they're on this machine and do the transplant at a time of our choosing, and also in a way that doesn't require a transplant team to be available 24/7, 365 to rush out in the middle of the night. I think it might surprise maybe some of your listeners and viewers, but transplant teams are not a mom and pop corner grocery store, even at a place like Stanford, where I spent most of my career. Not heavily staffed with surgeons and physicians. It's a lean team. Yeah. It has to be for a lot of different reasons. So the procurement process has to be made more efficient. I have a dream one day, being a bit of a futurist myself, is that the organs will actually show up at the hospital door where the transplant's happening on one of these devices, and the transplant team will wake up, go to the hospital, put them in somebody at 7 a.m. No more rushing around in the middle of the night. In fact, there could be distribution systems, all over mm-hmm. the country that recondition these organs and get them ready. I wrote a piece about this in the Wall Street Journal a couple of years ago now, and got a bunch of different reactions from people like Amazon and FedEx and Walmart. And, you know, their basic message was simple. They said, look, this sounds like a distribution problem. This is moving product at the end of the day. I had never really considered the human organs product, but mm-hmm. that's how they looked at it.
Yeah.
And, you know, those are the folks that I think can ultimately help us with this problem, because too many organs go to waste, largely because of the distribution system that's in place right now. And I want to be, in an effort of full disclosure, I work with a company called Transmedics that has something called the organ care system that is in this exact space. And I just want to make sure I give that full disclosure.
Yeah. What about, as far as from the first standpoint, you may not see same animals, what about the area of just creating, just, you know, as if we were growing cartilage or something like that, just being able to, you know, the world of stem cell now has opened us up. The idea of stem cells, that there are some that can morph into anything and others that can only become one thing, and using younger stem cells, helping us regenerate in that area, looking the future, what excites you the most on that side of it?
3D printing, and I work with a company that essentially has developed a collagen scaffolding. So in other words, collagen is a protein within the body that provides the connective tissue in nearly every organ. But basically that scaffolding would have to exist just like the scaffolding that exists outside of a building when it's being repaired or cleaned or something, and lung cells. And with this scaffolding, then we hope we can actually create an artificial organ that will be suitable to use for transplantation. So quite apart from xenotransplant, which is using animal organs, we hope we can actually create them ourselves at some point. And it may not be as far off as, you know, we originally thought. It may be coming fairly soon.
Define fairly soon.
I'd say 5 to 10 years, you know, and that's soon in our business to at least do a clinical trial. You know, I think that, you know, having the technology is one thing, but actually testing it out in humans is quite another. And I think it'll be ready for clinical trials in 5 to 10 years.
See, I think that's exciting.
Yeah.
It changes everything. I think it's wonderful. And Alon says, is it true that they are growing transplantable tendons, ligaments, and cartilage that can replace those that are damaged? And this is from Jonathan in Phoenix, Arizona.
Yes. And using a lot of the technology I just spoke about with regard to making organs, you can also make tissue. You know, we also have a tissue shortage donation issue in the country, just like an organ donor shortage. And we're starting to be able to create tissue as well. So all that's coming, and it's coming quickly.
That's great. That made me think of athletes and stuff, where is this the type of thing that what's going to help us to get there sooner is going to be the multi-million dollar athlete that needs to have a knee place, needs to have tendons or ligaments or something? Because I think back to with back operations, and I think it was the 80s, that one of the first laminectomies that I'd ever heard of was on Joe Montana.
Yeah.
And I was somebody who had also had a back injury at that time, but nobody was talking about it. They were talking about fusions. And all of a sudden, after Joe Montana gets one, and I think it was 8 weeks later, he's playing in the Super Bowl, or, you know, all of a sudden, laminectomies were something that was now mainstream, and you could now go get it for anybody. Do you see a similar type of thing in transplants? What do you think it's going to take for it to take the next big jump?
I think the need has already been identified, and I think that's a lot of folks working on it already, such that it's rapidly getting ready for prime. So evolve out of sports medicine, actually. And I think that in transplantation, for instance, you know, at the end of the day, it's an organ, but it's made of tissue. And I think the same kind of tissue techniques can be used in transplantation to get that ball rolling as well. So it's already happening. And again, I work with companies that are in that space.
Okay. Well, I mean, what are some of the things that you can share with, if right now, if this show was based on, you had a bunch of futurists and they were all looking to you and saying, what can we expect to come down, to be coming down the path for us? and then what can people do to help make that happen sooner? I mean, is it, you know, if there's a holdup at the government level, is there a thing doing that their congressman or their legislature or whatever? So again, two things. What is it that you would tell people to look for coming up? And what can we do to help?
I think most of the work right now is happening in small, you know, smallish private companies that are working on the platform. In other words, they're not so much saying, well, we've got this lung built or we've got this heart built and it's ready to go. They want to make sure that they marry themselves with somebody that can make heart cells or make lung cells. But provide the companies right now can provide the scaffolding, that is the substance where heart cells and lung cells can actually be attached to, so that one day we'll have an organ. I'm not sure that there's anything the lay public can actually do about that right now. It's one where the investment has actually been very strong, because I think those who work with small companies like myself as a consultant see that private equity money, venture capitalists are all over this whole field, because I think they see the future of it. So I find that exciting. Okay. I find it gratifying and exciting.
Well, it sounds like if there's angel investors out there, it sounds like that's where they should be headed towards, you know, is to head into these particular areas. Another thought that has to do with when you mentioned healthcare, and before we went on the show, we talked a little bit about healthcare. Tell us a little bit about some of your thoughts of some of the things that could be done in healthcare.
I think that we're, you know, in broad strokes, we're not getting our money's worth in American healthcare right now. The system is really not a system at all. It's actually hundreds, if not thousands, of different profit centers. I mean, that's what American healthcare is right now. And it's not working. It's not working for the patients, and it's not working for the people for providing the care. And I think COVID has peeled back the curtain on that. I know there's a lot of emphasis right now on healthcare provider burnout. that's been going on for a long time. And it's been written about for a long time and recognized by those of us in the field for a long time. And it has less to do with the individual, him, herself. It's really because of the system. There's external factors that make the practice of medicine, the conduct of clinical care, nearly impossible for the providers. And a large focus of what I'm doing right now is to try to identify those factors. As I go around talking about my book, one thing that I really want to emphasize is the environment in which we practice medicine right now is not patient friendly, and it's not friendly to the people providing the care either. It's just not working. And I think we have to recognize that.
How much of the problem do you think is the levels of bureaucracy that have been continually added?
That's a big part of the problem, Alan. I mean, there's a graph that I show in some of the presentations that I give. It shows the number of physicians and nurses flat over about 30 or 40 years, and the number of administrators in the hospital system going parabolic, straight vertical. And there's a lot of different reasons for that, but they really all point back toward money. And, you know, we in America provide healthcare for profit, and that's what we're doing. You know, and we need to acknowledge that, and we need to say out loud that we've really put profit over purpose in American healthcare. Mm-hmm. It's become soulless, I think, in my view, and it didn't happen overnight, and the fix won't be overnight, but it's happened over a number of years, where the difference between when I entered medicine and now, night and day, one could easily say that American medicine was the best in the world. I think that was, I think it was not a debatable point. I think it's highly debatable now.
And you mentioned you have a graph. And so at one time, I remember looking at statistics that this has now been a little while, but you may know this better. One of the things that I found shocking was the percentage of the GNP of any given country and compared to us that was going to healthcare. And it was so astronomical that I remember just being shocked. Do you know what that is?
Yeah, I do. I mean, we spend about $4 trillion per year in America for healthcare. And that represents 18 to 19% of our GDP. And it's thing that I get return on it. And, mm-hmm. you know, we spend a lot of money on healthcare, but not a lot of money on health, if that makes sense. We're kind of trying to fix things when they've already reached a critical point, and that's why it's so expensive. But mm-hmm. again, getting back to the COVID example, you know, we've realized what's the price of comorbid conditions like diabetes and hypertension? What's the price of obesity in our country? What's the price of cigarette smoking? The price is high. And
exactly. And it's the prices on all of us. That's the whole thing.
No doubt about that. But not only do you and I and other folks pay for it, we also, because we're all patients eventually, right? Mm-hmm. We also, broken system for everyone, but everyone means you and me. And
the issues
that I'm concerned about and writing about now are more global ones with regard to healthcare. And I'm not talking about writing about, you know, a wonky kind of policy driven, you know, textbook about healthcare economics. I'm talking about telling stories and showing examples of where we've lost our fastball. Again, you know, I've seen it during my 30-year career, where we've essentially gone from being the envy of the world to the laughingstock in American healthcare because the system is incredibly broken. It's amazingly broken.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love the fact that you're still you're still out there focusing on this and taking it to the. So what is the best way for listeners or viewers to find the book and to get in contact with you, and especially if you have any way that they can connect with you so that when the next book comes out as well, they can be on the list and ready to get it?
Sure. Probably the easiest way to find out what I'm up to and what I'm writing and working on is David Weill, David, WEILLMD.com. It's pretty much got everything there. I'm also on social media, pretty easy to find these days on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, you name it. And I answer anybody that wants to talk to me, I talk to them. So if anybody shoots me a message, I'm happy to discuss any of these topics with them.
I appreciate it. And I assume the book is at everywhere you can get your book, everything from your your local bookstore to Amazon or Barnes and Noble or whatever.
Yeah, and my website actually has links to all of your favorite booksellers. So it's also pretty easy to go on my website. Yeah.
Okay. And for those of you, if you're driving and you can't write this down, we will make sure that we have that information on the answers.network website as well, so that you can get all of David's information. David, thank you so much. And not just for coming on the show, but for everything that you're doing. You're saving lives. It's something I talk about in this show so much is that, you know, we need more people like you, but we also need you getting that information out there. There's so much negativity as far as information that's put out, and everything seems to be a doom and gloom. And to be able to have information, again, like your book that is talking about the miracles of saving people's lives. I mean, you know, it's just, if we can get more people focused on this, you know, I think that we're all going to be, you know, mentally and physically.
Yeah, the stakes are high, but, you know, I think my book points out pretty well that it's a fight worth having. So I agree.
Yes. Definitely. So, and as I said before, so keep us posted in regards to when the next one's coming out. We'd love to have you back on. Would love to talk to you some more. And again, thank you so much for everything you do.
I enjoyed it, Alan. Really, thank you for having me.
All right. For everybody out there, please plan on being with Rachel Cove and I next Monday when we're going to be joined by Cody Lowery to discuss his revolutionary new book, Schmooze, What They Should Teach You at Harvard Business School. And please visit our archives of past interviews at answers.network, or better yet, subscribe to the show through iHeartRadio, Spotify, SoundCloud, Stitcher, YouTube, with B-E. But we're also on Spreaker, Apple Podcast, or pretty much any podcast that you listen to. And if there's one you listen to and you don't find us, tell them to put our show on there. And know that if you like what you hear, please leave a thumbs up or a review. It helps us reach more people, and I want you to know I greatly appreciate it. And the next time you're on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, please stop by our pages, check out some of our latest posts or shows, and if you like them, please like us and spread the word. So for everybody out there, be good human beings, and be with us again next week on Answers Network.
Hello, I'm Marty Cove. You might remember me from roles such as Sensei in the Karate Kid films. I've done over 100 films and countless stunts in my career, and I've always given 100%. With the digit to my mind, my passion for health and fitness drove me to find a natural way to combat muscle pain. Teaming up with doctors, detectives, and a compounding pharmacist, we've created Marty's Cobra Cove Ultra Strength CBD Cream. It's the only thing that has been strong enough to knock out my pain, and fast. Honestly, you may have tried the rest, but it's time to try the best. It's legal, it's safe, and 100% effective. Show your pain no mercy. Go to www.martyscobracove.com.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.